Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Karen Orenstein, Deputy Director with Friends of the Earth, who examines President Trump's false rationale for pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord and the consequences for the global effort to address the growing threat of climate change. Mark Maurer, Executive Director of the Sentencing Project, who assesses the Trump administration's order to reimpose drug war-era harsh sentences in federal drug cases. And Kathy Kennedy, a member of the California Nurses Association National Nurses Organizing Committee Board of Directors, who discusses the campaign to win single-payer health care legislation in California. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Guardian newspaper reports more wealth is extracted from sub-Saharan Africa than is provided to the continent in foreign aid, loans, and African nationals sending remittances home from abroad. Africa is often portrayed as a continent in desperate poverty, in need of urgent aid. Yet Africa has plentiful and valuable natural resources vital to the global digital economy. But a large percentage of these resources are controlled by foreign corporations or corrupt local officials who hide their ill-gotten gains in tax havens. A coalition of British aid and development groups recently released a report titled Honest Accounts 2017, finding that African countries received $162 billion in 2015, mainly in loans, aid, and personal remittances. But in the same year, $203 billion was extracted from the continent, either directly through multinationals repatriating profits and illegally moving money into tax havens, or by the rising costs of climate change adaptation and mitigation. This outflow of vast amounts of money resulted in 47 African nations accruing an annual $41.3 billion deficit, where many people remain trapped in extreme poverty. Aisha Dodwell of the group Global Justice Now declared, "What African countries need is for the rest of the world to stop systematically looting them." In the aftermath of the recent summit of the world's G7 nations in Taormina, Italy, Germany's conservative chancellor, Angela Merkel, was clearly angry at U.S. President Donald Trump when she declared, "We Europeans truly have to take our fate into our own hands." In a message to the strong anti-Trump majority in Germany, Merkel expressed frustration with Trump for refusing to endorse the Paris Climate Accord, which he later officially withdrew from. European leaders were also upset that the reality TV star real estate billionaire refused to endorse NATO's Mutual Defense Pact, which had been activated only once in its history, on behalf of the U.S. after the 2001 9/11 terrorist attacks. After the G7 summit, Merkel and newly elected French President Emmanuel Macron forged a pro-European consensus on climate change, globalization, and open markets. Before tempers cooled, however, Germany's foreign minister Sigmar Gabriel insisted, "Anyone who accelerates climate change by weakening environmental protection, who sells more weapons in conflict zones, and does not want to politically resolve religious conflicts, is putting peace in Europe at risk." Congressional Democrats have introduced a long-awaited piece of legislation to raise the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour by 2024. The bill would eliminate the subminimum wage for tipped workers, such as restaurant servers and taxi drivers. If enacted, axing the subminimum wage would uplift the working poor and put conservatives on the defensive on the issue of wage fairness. Currently, employers pay tipped workers only $2.13 an hour instead of the federal minimum wage of $7.25. There hasn't been a raise in the subminimum wage in 25 years. Moreover, according to the American Prospect, employers of tipped workers often cheat their low-wage employees. 80% of full-service restaurants investigated by the U.S. Department of Labor violated wage and hour laws. As a result, tipped workers suffer from a disproportionately high rate of poverty. If the federal minimum wage is increased to $15 an hour, it's estimated that 40 million workers would receive a raise, mainly benefiting women and people of color. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
President Trump announced on June 1st that he would withdraw the U.S. from the Paris Climate Accord, the global agreement signed by 195 countries in 2015 that set targets for reducing greenhouse gas emissions and limit the increase in global temperatures. During his announcement in the White House Rose Garden, Trump repeated claims, made often during the 2016 election campaign, that the Paris Agreement hurt the U.S. economy by deliberately putting the country at a competitive disadvantage and thereby contributing to unemployment. But analysis of these claims by several prominent news organizations found them to be generally false, relying on dubious statistics supplied by corporations and organizations which aggressively oppose the Paris Accord. Many Fortune 500 companies joined environmental groups, clergy, and the majority of the world's leaders in condemning Trump's decision. There was widespread criticism of Trump for what was judged by many to be a morally reprehensible decision. But many observers also expressed optimism that the global transition to clean energy will continue, with or without the United States government. At least 10 states and dozens of U.S. cities vowed to continue to live up to the commitments made in the Paris Accord, despite President Trump's decision to drop out of the pact. Your reporter spoke with Karen Ornstein, deputy director with Friends of the Earth, who examines Trump's false rationale for pulling out of the accord and the consequences for the global effort to address the growing threat of climate change.
I mean, I watched Donald Trump give the speech, and it was surreal. It was like hearing somebody claim that the sky is neon green when you know the sky is blue. He constructed his own reality, and maybe Stephen Bannon's reality, that somehow the Paris Climate Agreement was a conspiracy by the rest of the world to harm the U.S. in terms of jobs, in terms of economics. And he also created this scenario where, you know, he's number one on tackling the environment, but that's not what the Paris tackling environmental pollution, but that's not what the Paris Agreement does. The Paris Agreement's sole purpose is to hamstring the United States. And so it's like you have this uncle at the table who claims that the world is flat and there's no such thing as gravity. Where do you begin to try to counter the misleading statements, the untruths, the lies? The truth is the Paris Climate Agreement is basically a voluntary agreement among every nation in the world, except a few. Syria, they're not part of it because they're obviously in civil war, and Nicaragua because they thought Paris Agreement was too weak, which I would agree with. It is too weak. Now the United States, and it basically is just the first time that you have every nation on Earth, now minus three, committing to do something, whatever that country determines is in its best interest towards climate change. And there's no sort of sanctions or compliance regime to make sure that what you say you do is actually going to be done. So the U.S. could have, you know, said, well, as part of our climate change commitment, we will, this is what Donald Trump could say, we're going to contribute 3 red balloons, and that's our climate change commitment. And the rest of the world would have to say okay, because there's nothing binding here. And the reason there's nothing binding is because the whole world watered down their level of ambition in order to cater to the United States, because they knew that any sort of binding treaty would never make it through the Senate, the U.S. Senate. And basically, it was just a way to try to ramp up ambition going forward and to try to have some sort of diplomatic international framework for trying to tackle global climate change. And it was absolutely inadequate, but it was what we had, and we would try to improve on it. And we certainly have lots of criticisms of the climate agreement, but when you have somebody like Trump attacking it and lying about it for all the wrong reasons, it makes you have to sort of defend the minimum you have, which is right now the Paris Climate Agreement.
Karen, I wondered if you'd speak to the possible political consequences here. Is it possible that we might have a movement across the globe that would somehow seek to penalize or sanction the United States and the Trump government for the Paris decision. And I say that with the hope that any kind of boycott or sanctions against the United States would not affect average folks in this country. But it does send a message. We've seen that kind of tactic and strategy used around the world when a country becomes a rogue state, like many believe the United States has become under Trump.
Friends of the Earth, in our communications about what Trump is doing, we've called for, you know, governments and people of the world to deploy robust economic and political pressure on the United States to compel us to take meaningful climate action. With things like sanctions, I think we have to be careful that, like you said, we don't hurt ordinary Americans, frontline communities. So, but I do think there are all sorts of tools in the political and diplomatic toolbox and economic toolbox that can be used to further isolate the United States, because what we are doing is really going to cause death and destruction for hundreds of thousands, if not many millions of people, including here in the U.S. And I think these are early days. But there are people out in the streets everywhere, and I think people are having the conversations that you just brought up. Like, what do we do? Is this the time to, you know, have sanctions like they did in South Africa, or the boycott, divest, sanction movement in Israel, Palestine? Those are all just conversations that are starting to happen. I don't have any of the answers, but I think other countries absolutely have to treat the U.S. as sort of the political pariah that it has become. And there has to be consequences.
That was Karen Ornstein, Deputy Director for Economic Policy with Friends of the Earth. Find links to news and analysis on Trump's withdrawal from the Paris Climate Agreement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. News about Donald Trump's recent trip abroad, his decision to pull the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Agreement, and the ongoing investigation into charges that the Trump campaign colluded with Russia to influence the outcome of the U.S. presidential election has dominated the news for the past 2 weeks. But during that time, Trump has launched another major shift away from Obama-era policies that has mostly slipped below the radar. That's the announcement by Attorney General Jeff Sessions of a return to a tough-on-crime policy in federal sentencing guidelines, and also on the use of private prisons for federal inmates. Criminal justice reform has been one of the rare areas of bipartisan cooperation in recent years, especially at the state level. There, conservatives and liberals have often been united in an effort to stem the explosive growth in the U.S. prison population that began in the 1980s and is now just beginning to level off and even drop in some cases. The vast majority of the more than 2 million people incarcerated in the U.S. are in state prisons and county jails and won't be affected directly by these changes at the federal level. But the Trump administration is setting a tone that will make it more difficult for politicians to escape the label of soft on crime if they oppose Trump's harsh new measures. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Mark Maurer, executive director of the Sentencing Project, who assesses these policy changes and their likely future repercussions.
Within a week of taking office, the Attorney General reversed an Obama-era decision on the use of private prisons in the federal system. Last summer, the Department of Justice had announced that it was phasing out the use of private prisons at the federal level, basically for two reasons. One, a report by the Office of the Inspector General had found substantial problems of safety and security in the private prisons they were contracting for. And secondly, for a number of reasons, the federal prison population has declined fairly substantially in recent years, so there was less need for them to rely on extra beds from private prisons. With very little evidence or rationale, Attorney General Sessions just overturned that order, said they were very committed to using private prisons, and that would continue under this administration. Attorney General Sessions has reversed a policy put in place by Attorney General Eric Holder that recommended that federal prosecutors use their discretion to avoid imposing a mandatory minimum sentence in cases of low-level drug crime. The mandatory minimums in the federal system pose what are frequently very harsh 5, 10, 20-year minimum sentences and can be imposed even on relatively low-level players in the drug trade. And Holder, based on much evidence, said this was ineffective, it was overly punitive, and it was wasteful in many ways. Attorney General Sessions has now overturned that and basically has charged his federal prosecutors to seek the highest possible sentence they can prove in every federal case unless there are extreme circumstances that would warrant doing otherwise. So this can only result in increasing numbers of people both going to prison and especially spending more time in prison as a result of this policy initiative. And the Attorney General was not able to point in great detail to any problems of the Holder Initiative, but, you know, rather it was a return to the tough-on-crime days of the 1980s and 1990s that are now widely discredited across the political spectrum.
We know the crime rate has fallen pretty precipitously in the last 2.5 decades or so, but now, over the last year or two, it's actually gone up. So, Mark Maurer, how do you respond to that critique that blames the Obama administration for that?
Well, there are some supporters of Attorney General Sessions who make the argument that crime rates, particularly homicide, is going up in recent years, and this is because of Obama administration policies or similar ones at the state level, and therefore we need to implement these tough penalties. And if you look at this issue in context, there's not much there to make that argument. First, crime rates and violent crime as well have declined by nearly half since the early 1990s. There are a number of reasons this has happened, but most American communities are considerably safer today than they were 20 or 25 years ago. It is true that in a handful of cities, Chicago at the top certainly, rates of murder have escalated substantially in the last couple of years, and that should be cause for concern. But there are two issues that really get at the federal system. One, the number of people going through the federal system is only about 13% of the total in terms of number of prisoners in the country. So even with some reduction in recent years, there's no way such a modest proportion of the total could have a substantial impact on any given city. Secondly, what we know about crime rates and violent crime is that much of this is driven by local conditions. If there were truly a problem of people coming out of prison committing crime, we should be seeing dramatically rising rates of murder all across the country, and that's certainly not what we're seeing. So we do know that local conditions, which may include the presence of gangs, it may involve type of policing that's going on, it may involve the availability of illegal weapons, particularly for teenagers. All of these factors can drive short-term spikes in crime in different places. So we need to address those local conditions, but doing a sort of one-size-fits-all federal approach emphasizing harsh sentencing is not getting at all at those underlying conditions.
That was Mark Maurer, Executive Director of the Sentencing Project. Find more analysis and commentary on the Trump administration's criminal justice policies by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As President Trump and the Republican-controlled Congress pushed to repeal Obamacare and institute a new healthcare system, that would cause an estimated 23 million people to lose their health insurance coverage, the nation's largest state is moving in the opposite direction. Proposed legislation, SB 562, known as the Healthy California Act, would establish a universal single-payer health insurance system that would provide coverage for all of California's 39 million citizens without any out-of-pocket costs. The measure, led by Democratic California State Senator Ricardo Lara, won Senate passage on June 1st by a vote of 23-14. The legislation now goes to California's State Assembly, where details about the financing of the proposed new healthcare system must be fleshed out. While Republican opponents of the bill say the state can't afford such an ambitious plan, the California Nurses Association, which supports the bill, produced a study that finds raising the state's sales and business receipts taxes by 2.3% would raise $106 billion of the annual cost, with the balance coming from state and federal funding, already going to Medicare and Medicaid services. Your reporter spoke with Kathy Kennedy, a registered nurse and a member of the California Nurses Association National Nurses Organizing Committee Board of Directors. Here she discusses the campaign to win single-payer health care in California, the coalition supporting the bill, and the challenges ahead for final passage of the legislation.
Senate Bill 562, which is the Healthy California Act, essentially says this, is that it guarantees health care as a human right for all Californians, residents of California, and it provides real health security for all of our residents, which is a comprehensive benefit, which means that you have complete choice of providers and there's no out-of-pocket costs. So when we talk about, you know, comprehensive benefits, we're talking about, you know, there's not going to be any co-pays, there's not going to be any more deductibles, and that comprehensive benefit includes in- and outpatient care. It also includes dental. I think a lot of times people think that, you know, dental care is not part of health care, but it is. Vision, prescription drugs, rehabilitation, immunizations, all those things that people struggle every day. You know, here in California, we have those that are insured, and then we have some that are underinsured. And so a lot of people, you know, they, you know, with the ACA, we had more Californians that were covered under the Affordable Care Act, but because the co-pays and the deductibles were so high, a lot of patients couldn't afford to use their insurance. SB 562, that would totally eliminate that. So there would no longer be the need to have any co-pays or out-of-pocket costs.
Kathy, what's the next step in the legislative process to move this idea of universal health care forward for the state of California?
As you know, we got it through the Senate, so now we are going to, you know, this bill is being brought to the Assembly. So we need to push our Assembly members to pass this particular bill. And we know that there's going to be some discussion about the financial study and such. And then once it gets through the Assembly, then it has to go back to the Senate. Again, I believe it's a two-thirds vote, both at the Assembly and then again at the Senate, and then it will go to the governor's desk. So we have a lot of work ahead of us, but I'm telling you, in California, we have so many organizations that are behind this bill. It's amazing. I've gone to several town hall meetings in Northern California, and people are excited. They really think that it is time. People are tired of insurance company profiting off of healthcare, and that's just not something that should happen. So people are really ready to get out and, you know, do the hard work and make this happen.
What about Governor Jerry Brown, a fairly progressive politician over many decades? What's his view of this single-payer system being proposed in California?
Well, you know what? I don't, you know, it personally, you know, I wonder too, because I think for years our governor has always talked about, you know, having a single payer system, and right now he's not quite sure. And he wanted to see the financial study. So we presented, you know, we have it now, and my hope, CNA's hope, National Nurses United hope, is that, you know, once the bill gets to his desk, that he would sign it, because we have clearly shown through the financial study that this is possible, and families will have savings and businesses will have savings. So I think that we just need to convince Governor Brown that this is possible, and, you know, we have the proof, so we just have to push.
You know, one of the things that I think we can look to is that when the nation of Canada adopted their system of universal single-payer health care, it happened first in one of their provinces, in Saskatchewan. And the system worked so well there in Saskatchewan that it was adopted federally by the whole nation of Canada. Is mm-hmm. that something that in your dream of dreams you're hoping would happen if the roads were blocked for single-payer at the federal level, that an example set in California really could open up a lot of minds and a great example of how the single-payer system would work well in one state and thereby the entire country?
Yes, absolutely. You know, and as you know, California is one of the six largest economic systems, you know, as far as just the state alone, because a lot of things, as you know, happen in California, and then we really want to lead the way. And so that is the reason why we are pushing so hard, along with all of our other colleagues, all the other organizations. It is a coalition, and we are working together, and we are determined to make this happen in the state of California.
That was Kathy Kennedy, a registered nurse and member of the California Nurses Association National Nurses Organizing Committee Board of Directors. For more information on the Healthy California Act single-payer healthcare plan proposal, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WESU in Middletown, Connecticut, KGNU in Boulder, Colorado, KYRS in Spokane, Washington, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.